Hey there, this is Virginia Prescott with producer Sarah Plourd. What? I mean, what?
We're having a secret drive.
Got it. If you love the show, consider making a small donation to the station where we make it, and we will send you some secret swag.
What is it?
I can't tell. It's a secret.
All right. Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in to get yours.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope that you will make some noise for word of mouth.
The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In April of 1865, less than a week after General Robert E. Lee's surrender of the Confederacy, a nation shredded by a four-year war was reeling once again. Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated. As word of the president's death spread, the public mourned his loss, mostly. Their response reflected a country divided by a contentious civil war that pitted brother against brother. And while many citizens lamented the loss of the leader, others cheered, not only in the South. Martha Hodes is professor of history at NYU and author of the book Mourning Lincoln, which delves into the aftermath of the tragedy. We spoke with her when the book was first published. It's now out in paperback. So what was the state of the Union when Lincoln was shot on April the 14th, Good Friday, we should add, 1865?
Well, the war had just ended, the Confederacy had just surrendered, and all sides were relieved in many ways. Union supporters were jubilant. Confederates were in complete despair. And then on top of both of those feelings and emotions came the assassination, the nation's first presidential assassination.
How did people find out about the shooting and death of Lincoln?
Well, the Telegraph, wherever the Telegraph ran, the newspaper journalists would go to the Telegraph offices, get the telegrams, and print the headlines. So the Telegraph and newspapers spread the word as early as that day. But what's really fascinating is, as the newspaper boys ran through the streets, the first people to get the news were laborers who were up early in the morning cooking for their masters, building fires, the milkman delivering the milk. And so the working classes got the news first and often delivered it to their masters.
Hmm. Did people believe it? Did they have to somehow verify it?
Oh, people didn't believe it. It was literally incredible, literally unbelievable. People wrote in their diaries and in letters that they were stupefied, astounded. People invoked the metaphor of a thunderbolt from a clear blue sky. A former slave said she felt an electric shock to my soul. It was simply too horrible and too terrible to believe. Mm. People said it was like a play on a stage. So today we would say, I felt like I was in a movie.
Was there any, you know, we didn't have photographs then. There were no newspapers or videos, certainly shouted about the internet. Did they need proof somehow that it actually happened?
Yes, that's such a good question, because now, of course, we think we would turn to our televisions, we turn to our cell phones, and we turn to social media. What people did in 1865 was they turned to the human face. So not Facebook, but human faces. So they immediately, when they saw the newspaper headlines, they ran outside. The first thing to do was to look into other people's faces. If other people's faces were stricken, if tears were rolling down their cheeks, men and women, then they knew they weren't dreaming. They weren't in a play on a stage. And that was a major means of verification.
This was, as you mentioned, the first presidential assassination. With no precedent for what should happen in these kind of cases of national emergency or tragedy, what did people do? I mean, did businesses close? Were flags flown at half-mast? Did people stay home from work?
Absolutely. So business seemed to stop, although the only stores that remained open were stores that sold black goods that were for mourning drapery. People would write in their diaries things like, instantly the entire village or city was draped in black. Well, of course it wasn't instant. It was through the labor of various people. So women and workers were up on ladders and hammering black cloth and mourning bunting onto all of the facades. Businesses did close that morning, except, of course, if you sold black goods, and then you took in hundreds of thousands of dollars because everybody wanted to trim their flags with black and put black on their armbands and wear black badges. And so that was another way of proving what had happened, that the landscape was transformed.
But not everybody was grieving. I mean, we think of him today as the iconic president who changed the fate of the nation. Obviously, things were a little more complicated back then.
Yes, that's right. What's so interesting is that Lincoln's mourners write in their journals and letters that everyone, everywhere, all across the nation, even the world, was grieving. But they knew that wasn't true. So first of all, they knew that Confederates weren't grieving. Confederates had mixed feelings about Lincoln, but in many ways they despised him. And so Confederates rejoiced not only in private, but also in public. They thanked God, they cheered, they laughed, they clapped, they taunted African Americans. But the other thing is that there were Northerners, there were white Northerners who despised Lincoln too. These were the Copperheads, his political opponents. And they really confounded this idea of universal grief by laughing and cheering and waving their caps and displaying a kind of joviality that infuriated the mourners.
Was there any kind of punishment for this kind of disrespect?
Yes, there was. In fact, mourners were absolutely infuriated by people who displayed any sort of glee. And so this is both Lincoln's mourners in the North and Union occupiers in the South. So, for example, Union soldiers who were in front of Confederates. So they reacted violently with words and with actions. And Union soldiers who maligned the president, because not all Union soldiers loved Lincoln, were often brought up on charges of treason as an accessory after the fact of the crime. So we have a soldier from Maine who simply said in front of his comrades, "This is too good to believe." We have a soldier from New York who said, "Hip, hip, hurrah, Lincoln is dead." And all of those kinds of words and actions are recorded in these court proceedings.
Wow. Well, how about the mourners? I mean, I think of the 19th century as this time when people were reserved and stoic when it came to emotion. Did they show their grief publicly?
What's so interesting is that the rules of decorum in the 19th century were just as you said, and especially for men. You just weren't supposed to be particularly emotional, especially in public. Well, at this moment of the assassination, all the rules of decorum are just out the window. And especially, people write over and over again in their letters and diaries that men were weeping. Hmm. People write about ministers breaking down. There's an example of a person writes in a diary, "The minister broke down and the tears rolled down his cheeks." There's another example of "the minister could only get through the sermon with a violent effort of self-control." That was the phrase this woman used. And men are walking down the streets weeping, wiping their eyes, looking into one another's faces. Women are noticing their husbands crying and writing down that this is the first time they've seen men cry. And people are not ashamed of this. It is such an enormous catastrophe for Lincoln's mourners.
I'm speaking with Martha Hodes about her new book, Mourning Lincoln, which takes a personal look into the lives of ordinary citizens in the aftermath of the assassination of President Lincoln 150 years ago. You also write a lot in the book about the far less recorded population, those of the African American, the slaves, and also those who were free African Americans, their reaction to Lincoln's death. First of all, how did you find these accounts?
Well, it was much more difficult to find written accounts of African Americans. Now, there are African Americans who did, certainly African American soldiers who were literate and wrote letters, and there were some African Americans who kept diaries that have been preserved. But largely, I read African American newspapers in which, for example, soldiers would write letters to the newspapers. And I also read the writings of whites who worked with African Americans. So, for example, Northern missionaries who worked with African Americans during the war down south. And say a teacher was teaching a class and somebody would come in and give the news of the assassination. And then the teacher would write a report back to the missionary association recording what people did. So, for example, a young child who said, "Does this mean we have to be slaves again now that Lincoln is no longer alive?" Mm. And we have just bereft Union soldiers, the black men. Also, fear was a response on the part of African Americans. Fear about emancipation, fear about equality, fear about citizenship that they thought might not come to pass now. And of course, free African Americans in the North, they wrote about feeling stricken down and hopeless. And Frederick Douglass called it an unspeakable calamity, the assassination.
Hmm. I'm thinking about times of national tragedy that we can remember. You know, September 11th comes to mind, and you actually write about that a bit in your book. Despite all of the sort of differences between people, between populations, this was a time of unification after September 11th. You know, the country was sort of defiant. How about then? We had a country that had been divided for so long. Did this national tragedy create a kind of balm for those ills or further drive a wedge in between the sides?
Well, what's interesting about 9/11 is that when I was writing this book, I thought back and I remembered it just as you said. I remembered it as a time of national unity. But in fact, when I looked back at the photographs I'd taken in the streets of New York on September 12th, the next morning, I saw all kinds of arguments going on. Some people wanted revenge. Some people wanted peace. Some people didn't want to trust the media. So the signs that I took pictures of made clear this kind of contention. And the same kind of tension and contention was absolutely true in 1865. Mourners might have felt unified, but they were at tremendous odds with Lincoln's enemies and still at tremendous odds with Confederates. There was still a war going on off the battlefield, even though Robert E. Lee had surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant.
The war, of course, claimed the lives of more than 750,000, if you think about the size of the population, that is so significant. And you mentioned in the book that meant nearly everybody knew someone who died in the Civil War. How did that affect how mourners responded to the death of Abraham Lincoln?
Very important. So that figure that you gave is about 2% of the population at the time, which translates into almost what would be today, 7 million lives lost. So as you said, everybody knew somebody. Lincoln's death in some ways seemed like the ultimate death or the last casualty of the Civil War, but it wasn't literally so because men kept dying in Union hospitals and at home and in camp. But Lincoln's funeral and the mourning for Lincoln gave people a chance to publicly express what had just become a parade of one local funeral after another, because his death was such an enormous event that it gave them a moment to express that grief for their own loved ones in a public setting.
How long did this mourning of Lincoln publicly continue?
Well, Lincoln's body was taken on a two-week, 1,700-mile journey after the funeral in Washington, which took place on April 19th, and he was buried, the train took him to his hometown of Springfield, Illinois, where he was buried on May 4th. So all of this went on for 2 weeks, and many of the mourners followed every report about the funeral train, and there were funerals in 11 major cities along the way, and the train passed through many, many towns and villages where people would come to look at it. Then after the funeral was over, people still left up their bunting. They often left it up for weeks after that. Soldiers on their way home from the war would pass through towns and write in their diaries that the mourning bunting was still up from the funeral. People took a long time to give it away, to take it down, so it lingered for quite some time.
Martha Hodes, I want to thank you for joining us. A fascinating topic.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Martha Hodes, professor of history at NYU and author of the new book, Mourning Lincoln. We do have a link to more information on the book. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Martha Hodes, professor of history at NYU and author of the book, Mourning Lincoln. We spoke to her when the book was first published. It is now available in paperback. Countless books and films and articles on the Civil War, but there is another more physical way for people to experience events that took place 150 years ago, historical reenactments. A few years ago, a passionate group of Civil War buffs ceremoniously reenacted a Union funeral, and producer Jake Warga was there.
Ready! Aim! And shoulder, arm.
The man we are honoring here is Dr. Benjamin F. Fuller. He served with Company C of the 22nd Pennsylvania Cavalry. God of all nations and Father of us all, listen to our prayers. Give your beloved peace.
Honor detail. Ready. I'm a colonel.
Steve Betchert.
Aim.
I'm 57.
Fire! Load.
I'm what's called a field officer. I'm a baby boomer that didn't go to Vietnam and didn't ever serve in the military. I spent 35 years in the classroom trying to help students understand the history of their country. War is a terrible, stupid waste of human life. You should do everything you possibly can to avoid it. Okay? This war took the lives of 2% of the entire American population. 620,000 Americans. It changed the country. In the end, it did free the slaves, 4.5 million slaves, and it did unite the country and make it into one nation. People used to say the United States are. After the war, they said the United States is. The whole concept of being a nation came from this war.
Ready! Aim! Fire. Load!
We're both wearing hoop skirts, and then I'm wearing a ball gown. 1860. Okay, I'm Allison Fletcher.
And I'm Carly Welty.
We're 14.
Yeah. It's actually really hard to, like, walk around and stuff. Like, you have to be careful, like, how you sit with the hoop skirts. I liked that time era a lot. And you got to, like, you got to be outside more and stuff. And you got to have, like, everybody had horses. And you got to wear these kinds of clothes and dresses and stuff all the time. It probably feel really scary to feel like somebody else just still living in your own country was against you. And your,
and like the middle,
and what you were fighting
like
for.
The middle states, they had people, like families, some went to Union, some went to the Confederate, so you'd be kind of fighting your own brother.
Yeah.
Well, like, no war is happy.
Yeah. I think war will always be persistent because everybody is always disagreeing on stuff. So, yeah, sadly enough, I don't think there'll ever not be a war.
Ready! Aim! Fire! Freeze, and...
I'm Harold Slavik. I'm the commander of the Edward D. Baker Camp No. 6, Sons of Union Veterans of the Civil War. I've been a Civil War buff for years. My great-great-grandfather got here in time to fight for Company K of the 54th New York Infantry for 2 years. See, we are the descendants of and the heirs of the old Grand Army of the Republic. I am wearing period correct Union uniform. This is called a sack coat. Yes, I was in the Air Force. Well, I was a cook and a baker. I never left the States. Because of finding out about my great-great-grandfather, I can say with great pride, my family has put on the uniform from the Civil War to Vietnam, and I'm very proud of that. We have the best country in the world, bar none, for all of its faults and all of its mistakes. It's still the best damn experiment going. And the fact that I bet was allowed, and my family has been allowed, to pay the rent for being born under that system. That's where the pride comes in.
Ready! Aim! Fire!
That's why we're here, is to tap people on the shoulder of the modern world and say, hello. Don't forget us.
And our thanks to Jake Warga, who produced that piece. Each week on his Song Exploder podcast, Hrishikesh Hirway invites musicians to break apart the songwriting process piece by piece. In this latest episode, the band Old Crow Medicine Show delves into the making of Dearly Departed Friend, about the funeral of a veteran.
My name is Ketch Secor, and I play the fiddle in Old Crow Medicine Show. I remember Operation Desert Shield. All through the night, every one of our favorite shows had been preempted by night vision flashes of airstrikes on Baghdad. And at 12 years old, I knew that I was captivated, but I also knew that I thought the war was wrong. The very next day in school, there was a great big speech all about this new time we were living in and George Bush and his decision to put these airstrikes together. And I remember not standing for whatever we sang, whether it was God Bless America or whatever it was. and getting in a lot of trouble for it, getting pulled out of the room. I had a really wonderful principal, and he was a sweetheart of a guy, but he told me then, well, Ketch, the way I think about it, you love it or you leave it. So I really came up in a love it or leave it kind of town, and that sentiment is something that I've been wrestling with as a songwriter ever since.
Old Crow Medicine Show is a six-piece band from Tennessee who've been around since 1998. They were inducted into the Grand Ole Opry in 2013, and they won the Grammy for Best Folk Album in 2015 for the record Remedy. In this episode, Ketch Secor tells the story of how they made one of the songs from that record. It's called Dearly Departed Friend.
I'm just standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend.
I was always interested in the stories from Afghanistan. The kind of music that I play has found appeal among a number of veterans my age and younger, and older too. So I knew I wanted to write a song and write many songs from their perspective. This is a story about somebody from a place much like a lot of the places that I've lived before, these sort of crossroads, these sort of tri-cities with a sign out front that says, welcome to a certified business location, and all you see around are smokestacks. The story of Dearly Departed Friend really is centered in this town called Elizabethton, but up there they say it Lizbethton. Well, I lived sort of on the outskirts of Elizabethton, Tennessee, where Tennessee meets Virginia and North Carolina. There's pretty limited economic opportunity for the kids who would graduate from a place like Elizabethton High. So when I was living there, I would see other 18-year-old young men like me, and there were no jobs, so they just joined the military. The military was the best option going. I'd been dealing with this idea of a kid from the hills who goes over, and Dear the Departed Friend is about him coming home. In preparation for talking to you today, I was going through some old recordings I had made, and the demo, it's a lot different. It starts with sort of the bare bones, which was a lot more spoken. I really thought that this could be a song where I just ramble.
The service went the way it should have gone. No one talked too much or cried too long, except your mama's new boyfriend. Yeah, he went on and on and on and on about the country and the hero you'd become. Well, we were all bowed down, and just then a truck backfired and all the boys flinched their heads. Yeah, that choked me up pretty good, I guess. Been home a month now and still can't get no rest.
The music that I wrote for it changed entirely when we went to make a record on it.
The band worked with producer Ted Hutt to make the album.
When Ted Hutt got involved with this song, he treated it sort of like a hymn with more of an oratory approach to the vocal. Ted's ability to capture this band called the Dropkick Murphys, they are playing traditional Irish music at breakneck speed with a swagger that's very modern.
I'm headed for a life in the land of the free, sending every penny off to the family.
And we're playing sort of the wicked stepsister of Irish music, old time, or the sort of Appalachian string band music. We're playing that kind of thing with a whole lot of, you know, modern styling as well. And the thing about these genres is that they're very live. They're really energetic stuff. So how can you capture that live energy successfully and not compromise sonically? And that's what Ted was so good at doing. He really honed in on a melody line.
I'm standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend. Nothing much to say except sorry it turned out like it did.
To me, the song and the narration has a hard edge to it. From the vantage point of a guy who has seen a lot of things that the typical guy his age, unless he's been in combat, has not seen. So that colors his understanding of the world around him, this new world that he's re-entered. He's not the same boy who left.
The service went the way it should have gone. No one talked too loud or cried too long. Except your mama's new boyfriend. He went on and on while they laid you in the ground.
But it's not negative and it's not somber. It's just sort of plain. This is how it is. You're dead and we've buried you. And I live in this town now. And I drive circles around it.
And right about then, a truck backfired and all the boys, they flinched their heads. Yeah, that shook me up, I guess. I've been home a month now and I still can't get no rest.
And on this song, Dearly Departed Friend, the arrangement, there's an intricacy to this. It was a challenge. The hardest part about this song was trying to do something this slow in a band that normally plays at breakneck speeds. You know, trying to breathe through it, trying to approach it the way we do all songs, with a lot of gusto and fire, but not to lose the delicacy of the song. It was really difficult to slow it down this much. The pedal steel and its sort of ambient hum really feels akin to the story that's being told. Gil Landry spent a long time figuring out that pedal steel solo. In fact, he really bought a pedal steel to play this song. This is his pedal steel recorded debut. So he spent a lot of time working on it. The pedal steel is unrestrained by frets. It just moves. And our boy, our hero here, is adrift. He's not bound in by anything except the voices in his head. He's sort of letting the winds blow him, and they've blown him back home. And now he's letting the winds blow him all across town. Gitcho is a six-string banjo. Back in the teens and in the early 1920s, the banjo was the instrument. Everything got turned into a banjo. Banjo ukuleles, banjo mandolins, banjo guitars. And this is the banjo guitar. Gitchos don't really sound like banjos. They sound like gitchos. When you isolate it and you hear it solo, it ain't pretty. But stick it into a six-piece band and it kind of makes all the difference. I'm such a rudimentary mandolin player, but the reason that I did play that part is because what the song wanted was a rudimentary mandolin. When it comes to harmony parts, we just got to figure it out. Nobody in this group has the background and the science of, you know, notes and fifths and parts and all that stuff.
Standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend.
You know, we just know when it sounds right.
Nothing much to say except sorry it turned out like it did.
And in the choruses, that's the trio of Chance and Critter and I.
21 guns for 21 years and American flags in the wind. Standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend.
Particularly in the tradition that our music comes out of, harmony singing is just sort of taken for granted. That's the kind of singing, group singing, that's most exciting to me. And when we're good, we can do that in Old Crow.
I'm just standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend.
There wasn't a bridge originally when I wrote this song. And this was Ted saying, all right, I want it to go deeper here, guys. You know, we needed this big part with the drums and spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the kind of rumble would be. I really wanted it to be a rocket's red glare kind of a sound. Yeah, that's definitely the rocket's red glare and the bombs in the air.
Hey, there's only one road leads out of this town, and it comes right back. So I just drive in circles, circles, and I try not to blow my stack.
I wrote that line. That was all a new line, that there's only one road leads out of this town, and it comes right back. So I just drive in circles, and I try not to blow my stack. It was definitely a eureka moment. That bridge, to me, felt like the heart of the song. This song has broken the ice in a conversation that I've really wanted to have with the men and women in the United States Armed Services. And I really want to talk to them. I want to know what they're doing. I want to know what they're up to right now and how they feel about it. And I want them to feel my love and gratitude.
Now, here's Dearly Departed Friend by Old Crow Medicine Show in its entirety.
Service went the way it should have gone. No one talked too loud or cried too long, except your mama's new boyfriend. He went on and on while they laid you in the ground. Right about then, a truck backfired and all the boys, they flinched their heads. Yeah, that shook me up, I guess. I've been home a month now and I still can't get no rest. Standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend, with nothing much to say except sorry it turned out like it did. 21 guns for 21 years and American flags in the wind. Standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend. Barbecue grills and lawnmowers, kids on four-wheelers and ice cream trucks. Yeah, they buried you on a Saturday. Georgia lost to Tennessee. You would have liked that, I know. Afterwards, we went to old Charlie's. Your mama's boyfriend got drunk, saying it should have been me. I wish it was him, I mean. So I went home, got drunk, and watched the TV. I'm standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend, with nothing much to say except sorry it turned out like it did. 21 guns for 21 years and American flags in the wind. Standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend. Hey, there's only one road leads out of this town, and it comes right back. So I just drive in circles, circles, and I try not to blow my stack. Out at the mall in the motor mile, it's just as lonesome as I see. Man, the girls round here, the girls round here, they're just as hopeless as they used to be. So go on and tie another yellow ribbon round the old hack blackberry tree and tamp the dirt down. Y'all going home now. There ain't nothing here to see. Standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend, with nothing much to say except sorry it turned out like it did. 21 guns for 21 years and American flags in the wind. Standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend. I'm just standing by the grave of a dearly departed friend.
And that was the band Old Crow Medicine Show on the podcast Song Exploder, hosted by Hrishikesh Hirway. You find a link to the song at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Over 1,800 lives were lost, the deadliest maritime disaster in America. But other big headlines to compete with, no book deal and no blockbuster film to tell the story, chances are you've never heard of the sinking of the Sultana. Being left out of the history books can be a result of bad timing, the wrong place at the wrong time, and even having a name that's hard to rhyme with. Christopher Klein is a freelance writer and author, and he joins us to unearth the reasons behind forgotten history. We found his article, Eight Reasons We Forget Some Historical Events, at the Boston Globe. Welcome to Word of Mouth, Christopher.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks for coming in. And tell us more about the Sultana tragedy.
So this happens a couple weeks after the surrender of Robert E. Lee at Appomattox. And you have Union troops who fought in the battlefields down south, many of them who were also prisoners of war at Andersonville and Cahaba. And they survived the battles. They survived the POW camps. And now they're ready to go home. And they board the steamboat to take them up the Mississippi River from Vicksburg, Mississippi, up to Illinois. And it was pretty common at that time to have private steamboat operators to transport troops, and they were paid per head. So the owner and the captain of the Sultana was getting paid $5 a head for every man he put on board, $10 for an officer. And even though he was licensed for 376 passengers, he put 2,400 passengers on the Sultana. Mm. And he knew he had a leaky boiler that could be a problem too, but he didn't want to risk not getting his payday, so he told everyone to just patch the boilers. And the overloaded ship makes its way up the Mississippi River, and in the middle of the night on April 27, 1865, three of the boilers explode, and of the 2,400 men on board, 1,800 of them are suspected to have died in this tragedy.
Absolutely grisly explosion, too, from the sounds of it.
Yeah, I mean, there are hundreds who are died instantly just from the force of the explosion. And then it turns the steamboat into a floating inferno. And you have, back in those days, not many people know how to swim. The Mississippi River is swollen at flood stages and freezing. And people had basically make the decision they wanted to die by burning aboard the ship or die by drowning.
Absolute tragedy, but we hear so little about it.
Right.
Is it just because there was no film like the Titanic made about it?
That's part of the reason. And what really buries the Sultana in our collective memory is it's really a victim of poor timing. It happens the day after John Wilkes Booth is cornered and shot in a barn in Virginia. The body of Abraham Lincoln is still making its way across the country to its final resting place in Springfield, Illinois. There are still Civil War generals who are surrendering their troops out on the field. So it's sort of a victim of very busy news time. And then also, you know, it's the country was numb at that point, whereas today, you know, 1,800 people die. Of course, it's going to be just huge news. But in the Civil War, when you had 600,000 soldiers who died, you know, another 1,800 was sort of just a blip on the radar.
I'm thinking about bad timing. The remember the fertilizer explosion in Texas?
That's right.
Just about the same time, maybe a day or two after the Boston
That's right.
bombing.
Yep.
completely wiped off of the headlines. Well, but this story does have, it has greed, you know, it has tragedy, it has a sense of heroism. Isn't that a kind of narrative that we would want to remember?
You know, I think that there are a lot of instructive lessons that are in there that would make for a very interesting story. And there have been a number of authors who have written books about it, but it just doesn't have the same connection as the Titanic does in our mind, because the Titanic is just this classic story. And, you know, that's what we remember, that story part of history. You have this mighty ship that is...
feat of engineering, right?
Yeah, even the name Titanic, you know, it's you couldn't make that up. And it's a story about hubris and how the mighty will fall. And it has those classic storylines to go back to the days, you know, of the Odyssey. And the Titanic, of course, the victims were rich and famous. And, you know, people tend to gravitate to those kinds of stories as opposed to the men who were the soldiers on the Sultana.
Right. How about location? I mean, this is in the middle of the Mississippi River. It's not like Gettysburg. There's a battlefield. Does location make a difference
location
in whether or not?
Location makes a big difference. And events that happen in major media centers are going to be remembered a lot more than an event such as Sultana, which took place outside Mississippi, you know, sort of on the further reaches of where most of America was at that time. So that definitely plays a lot into it. And you will find in the course of history, you're going to remember these events that happen in big metropolitan areas. And a great example is we all remember the Great Chicago Fire, October 6, 1871. Wasn't even the deadliest fire that night. Just 250 miles to the north, there was a fire roaring through the lumber towns of Wisconsin, killed 10 times as many people as in Chicago. In fact, when they go to phone the governor to tell him about the fire, he's not there. He's in Chicago helping with the relief efforts. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have Mrs. O'Leary's cow sort of stuck in our collective mythological memories. But it, as I said, it wasn't even the deadliest fire that night.
Well, there are a lot of names that get sort of attached to these histories. Of course, Paul Revere. Why was Paul Revere remembered while others were not?
Well, Paul Revere basically got the biggest PR coup of his life 40 years after he died. And that was when Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. And Longfellow's poem botched a lot of the history. But it was a very memorable poem that school children were taught, and that's sort of the version of history that they remembered. The biggest person who gets left in history is the other writer that night, William Dawes. And you can make the argument that William Dawes had a tougher task than Paul Revere did on the night of April 18th, 1775, whereas Revere was crossing the water to get to Lexington and Concord, William Dawes had to get past the British guards by land. And he was able to sneak past those British guards and had a longer route to take to get out to Lexington and Concord. So he was just as much of a patriot hero as Revere was, yet we don't really remember him as much as Paul Revere.
Why do we remember some historical events and others are lost to the dustbin, as they say? Well, we're speaking with the writer Christopher Klein. He has come up with 8 reasons why we forget some historical events. A pretty instructive way to look at history going forward. It's also who we choose to remember. You write about Ona Judge and her legacy here in New Hampshire, barely remembered. Now, who was she and why do you think we've chosen not to celebrate her?
So Ona Judge is a slave living in Philadelphia in the 1790s. And she is about 20 years old. And she fled her master's house, gets on a boat and sails to Portsmouth and mixes in with the communities up here in New Hampshire. But what makes it notable is who her master was. And her master was George Washington, Martha Washington. And the house that she had left was the president's house. And she settled up here. And under the fugitive slave law that George Washington had signed into law, she could be brought back to Philadelphia to her owners. And the president did try to get some of his operatives to get her to come back to Philadelphia, but was unsuccessful in doing so. And I came across this story when I was reading this book by Andrew Carroll. It was called Here Is Where. And he was taking a look at these sort of forgotten historical tales, these unmarked historical sites. And he told this story about Ona Judge. And she lived in Greenland, New Hampshire, and that's where she died. And she's buried there. But her the plot of her house, her graveside, is basically unmarked. It's out in the middle of the woods. And, you know, he raised the question why this person who really embodies the motto of the Granite Estate, you know, live free or die, why isn't she remembered as much? And part of it is, you know, we know sort of that George Washington was a slaveholder, but we really don't want to think too hard about it, right? You know, it's one of these aspects that we build up our heroes and we don't necessarily want to see some of these flaws that in real ways are, make them human or ways for us to connect with them. But we put them on these mythological pedestals and we don't want to learn these stories necessarily that that show some of the sides that we don't want to see about them.
Right. Accuracy is not always the province of history. Rosa Parks, for example, was not the first woman of color to say, I do not want to ride in the back of the bus. Who was Claudette Colvin and why didn't she make the cut as the hero of the civil rights movement?
So she is a 15-year-old girl. And she is the first African-American to be arrested for not giving up her seat on the bus. The NAACP was looking to bring a test case, and they dug a little bit more into Claudette's backstory. But she had one aspect to her that the NAACP didn't think would present a great image, and that she was pregnant. She's an unwed prospective mother. And that did not fit the image of who they wanted to put out in front to be the face of this civil rights case. So they decide not to use Claudette. Rosa Parks, a few months later, she's arrested on the bus, and she fits more of the type, the more dignified, older woman. She works as a seamstress at the department store. She's the face that they want to put out in front. So even though she's not the first person to be arrested, she is the person that we remember in history.
Hmm. So what are the types of stories that we tend to keep out of our history books? Those unpleasant, they remind us of something we don't want to see. It's like, I don't know, it's like retrofitting history to suit our tastes.
Yeah, I mean, we have this tendency to whitewash history. As I said, we want to have these heroes that we put up front. And that also means that we tend to forget about history that don't have any natural leaders to them. One of the historians I spoke to for this piece, Ray Raphael, he makes the point that grassroots movements tend to get lost in history because by their nature, they do not have charismatic leaders. And he was talking even about Shays' Rebellion that happened in the early years of the Republic. And Daniel Shays was hardly even involved in the movement. But we put Daniel Shays into this leadership position that he never had. And we remember Shays' Rebellion because we remember Daniel Shea. And there was no Daniel Shea even put there by history. We probably wouldn't remember as much. So we remember those stories that have heroes. We remember those stories that glorify and extol those virtues that we want to feel not only about the historical figures but about ourselves as well. And there's stories that are out there that don't necessarily present the image that we want to have about ourselves, and we might forget them.
How can we remedy our collective forgetfulness?
I think what we need to do is we need to read about history, okay? I mean, these stories that I came across are ones that I never learned in school. And I think just the more you expose yourself to history, the more that you read about it, you're going to come across even these little kernels of information. We need to put out historical markers. We need to have these public events, commemorations, those things that lend ourselves into the collective memory. And that's how we build memories for future generations as well. I mean, there's a lot of value to a field trip. And kids who go on field trips to these historical places, that's where they get their, that's where they learn these stories. And the more that we can expose children to these stories, then we can sort of resuscitate some of these stories that have been lost to history.
Christopher Klein, freelance writer and author, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We found Christopher's piece, 8 Reasons We Forget Some Historical Events, at the Boston Globe, and you can learn more about the history we left behind by reading his article. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on this Memorial Day holiday. There is so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And do us a favor, please rate the podcast on iTunes. That'll let us know what you're thinking, and it'll help others find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2:00. with Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.